What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about a terrific podcast called Time to Eat the Dogs. It's hosted by Michael Robinson, a historian, and it's about exploration. Now, if you're clever, and I know you are because you listen to the New Books Network, you can probably figure out why a podcast about exploration would be called Time to Eat the Dogs. Well, Michael has interviewed many scholars and historians and researchers, and he even interviewed an astronaut about their books about exploration. You can find Time to Eat the Dogs at TimeToEatTheDogs.com. What else? You can also find it on iTunes. As I say, we really love this podcast at the New Books Network, and we love it so much that we're going to republish some of Michael's excellent interviews. And if I would just stop talking, which I'm going to do presently, you'll be able to hear one of those interviews. So I'm going to stop talking.
You know, one of the ways that American explorers like Henry Morton Stanley promoted his books and his lectures was by pushing the idea of darkest Africa. It was a term that had all kinds of meanings, racial, intellectual, geographical. So the question is this, when did Africa stop being darkest Africa in the minds of Americans? Time to Eat the Dogs. I'm Michael Robinson. Today, I speak with Jeanette Eileen Jones, author of In Search of Brightest Africa, Reimagining the Dark Continent in American Culture, 1884 to 1936. She talks about many different groups, from naturalists and conservationists to African-American artists and intellectuals, all of whom begin to recast Africa in the American imagination. Jones is an associate professor of history and ethnic studies at University of Nebraska, Lincoln. Jeanette Eileen Jones, thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
You talk a lot about Africa within the American imagination. I'm wondering if you could talk about what Americans thought of Africa, different communities of Americans in the 1800s.
Well, the project itself starts in the later half of the 19th century, but even in the early period, there's still a sense amongst Americans that Africa is pretty much the source of, and I would say white Americans, of the slave trade, right? Mm-hmm. Which, although it's abolished in 1807, that's primarily the relationship that America as a kind of nation, but also white Americans have with the continent. Of course, African Americans have a very complex and at times ambivalent relationship. Some people are still that are living in the early part of the century were born in Africa, directly from Africa via the slave trade. And so those individuals would have known Africa intimately, you know, the parts of Africa from which they came. And then, of course, you have the real first generation of so-called African-Americans or Creoles, those people born in the Americas. And their understanding of Africa most likely would have came from their parents or maybe even their grandparents. So there's a really kind of interesting idea of what Africa means. Is it home? Is it ancestral home? Is it a place of freedom as opposed to where people are in America, a place of bondage? And so I think what I'm interested in kind of when I look at the long 19th century is how those images and ideas about Africa change across time. And of course, as the slave trade is abolished, it really coincides with the rise of kind of race science at the same time. And of course, it predates 1807. And so you have Africa also entering into scientific thought via ideas about blackness, or at that time they would have called it Negroness, or race science that posits Africa as a particular place that produces a particular race that's on a racial hierarchy. So that's a kind of other layer to the ways in which whites and then people who are engaged in scientific communities thought about Africa.
In the late 19th century, you talk about how this image of darkest Africa became very, very common, especially within the writings of Henry Morton Stanley. Could you talk about darkest Africa and what that means?
Yeah, I mean, it actually predates Stanley, but as you know, because he used that term, darkest Africa, in his travel narrative, it gets some cachet. But, you know, the idea of a dark continent had existed long before then. The idea that Africa was unknown, or parts of Africa was unknown and still remains unknown, and that there was nothing in Africa that reflected a kind of, if you think about the progressive model, right, a progression of humanity. And so Africa is where you would find the lowest on the racial scale that were the racial scales that were erected at that time in terms of people, but also that the actual continent itself had not been subdued. Supposedly it was wild and it had not been conquered by man, right? And so that's the prevailing notion, is that Africa needs to be known to the world, but also needs to be brought into a new era, right? For people who are interested in going there and colonizing it, but also for people who want to go and do, for instance, missionary work and other types of so-called humanitarian endeavors. Yeah, so darkest Africa is really this idea that nothing really good can come out of Africa without some kind of intervention, right?
When I was thinking about the title of your book, which is In Search of Brightest Africa, I was thinking, wow, that's a really ambitious project, because as you just pointed out, darkest Africa has so many different meanings. It's a racial term. It's a term about knowledge. It's a term about light. And in talking about brightest Africa, it seems also that the brightness that you describe is so complicated. Could you talk a little bit about the evolution of that idea, how ideas about Africa began to change in the late 1800s?
Yeah, and it's really, I mean, it's multi-pronged, but I kind of look at two prongs. And one is really coming from Black intellectuals who are arguing that Africa either had a bright past, a glorious past, and you see people writing about that, particularly focusing on the eastern part, northeastern parts of the continent, but also talking about, you know, other parts of the continent where there are long histories of complex political, as they would have seen, a complex political organization, whether it's empires, monarchies, caliphs, caliphates, etc. And then there are those people who also believe, African Americans, that, you know, even if Africa isn't, quote, bright at that time, that it can become bright, and that part of their mission is to help that, right? Michelle Mitchell has written about this, is the so-called Black man's burden, right? Uh-huh. The missionary, Black missionaries going over there, but also school teachers. And of course, Liberia is very much tied to this project of Black modernity in Africa. Then the other problem that I look at are these naturalists, people who are in, sometimes I call them naturalist environmentalists, people who want to travel across Africa, but also believe that the charm of Africa rests in its pristineness, right? That it's a jungle or supposedly jungles that have not been subdued. It does have, as a continent, the most wide-ranging fauna and flora, or at least that was the belief on the planet. And so they go to Africa initially to get involved in collecting for botanists, also safari and collecting animal heads and bodies, etc. But then they kind of shift and start becoming conservationists and thinking about what Africa, what's special about Africa that needs to be preserved.
I really like the example that you give at the beginning of your book. You take us to May 1936, where you have these two different events happening in New York City, which kind of describe these different ideas of a bright Africa. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, one is the arrival of Colonel J.C. Robinson, right? The Black Condor, Bron Condor, who's coming back from Ethiopia. And he was serving as Haile Selassie's personal aviator, right?
Uh-huh.
And he comes into New York and he's met with fanfare. And later on, he starts to teach aviation at Tuskegee at the Institute, of course, and it's going to be part of the Tuskegee Airmen. And then the other event is the opening of the Africa Hall, or the African Hall, at the American Museum of Natural History, uptown. And so you have the opening of this hall, and at the same time, the celebration of this relationship between Africa, mainly Ethiopia, and African Americans through this figure of J.C. Robinson.
And in one case, you have people really pointing out the wild beauty of Africa and the need to conserve it and preserve it. And on the other hand, you have this this pilot who's pointing out some of the human rights issues going on in Ethiopia. Is that how we should read that?
And not just the human rights issues vis-a-vis, you know, what's happening with the Italian invasion, but also thinking about Ethiopia as a site of African Black excellence, right? And there are other scholars like Nadia Nuhr-Hussain and others who have written about kind of Ethiopianism, right, in American thought, and thinking about the resonance that Ethiopia has for people who want examples, current day examples, so not ancient examples, but current day examples of kind of Black governance, Black self-rule, Black manhood, right, in the figure of Haile Selassie. Now, whether or not they would have used that term Black in Ethiopia, that's the way they're interpreted in the United States by African Americans, as a Black empire, as a Black independent country in the midst of, you know, surrounded by colonial projects, right, or the colonies.
So when you were writing, you mentioned this idea of, well, I should maybe frame this in the readings that I do on history of exploration. This idea of white man's burden is everywhere, a kind of paternalistic attitude towards the other peoples of the world, and that it's in their best interest that Europeans and white Americans come in and civilize the place. But you talk a lot about black man's burden and how complicated some of the African-American attitudes towards Africa are. Could you describe some of these?
Yeah, I mean, I think one way to think about it is how people in a lot of African Americans have a very Western framework at that time, particularly had no connection to Africa directly, or in terms of like family memory or historical memory. And what you see in some of the, particularly late 19th century, some of these documents that are being produced by Black thinkers about Africa, it is a very paternalistic idea of the relationship between African Americans and Africa. For example, Alexander Crummell writes this, but others as well, that, you know, that the African Americans are the enlightened Blacks or enlightened Negroes of the world, right?
Uh-huh.
That because, you know, Providence, and when they say Providence, they mean God, sent sent them to these shores or had a, you know, they were able to gain all this knowledge of the arts and trade and Republican governance, and that this is the gift that they can then give back to Africa, right? That they can give to Africa, they can impart these skills. They could come there and bring modern business models. And that is really what's very tricky about that, because it is a redemptionist narrative that Black people can redeem themselves and find some kind of equality or freedom through this kind of work that they're doing in Africa. But of course, and for a lot of those thinkers, the Africans are not they're junior partners in the endeavor.
And yet you also talk about how, you know, this is also the period of the Great Migration, where you have African Americans migrating out of the South, creating artistic communities in Chicago and New York, and that for some of these artists, Africa became this place of inspiration. It's just interesting to me how these two things coexist. You know, it reminded me a little bit, and tell me if you think this is an apt analogy or not, but almost like this kind of Orientalism that Edward Said talks about, where you have white Europeans looking at the East and seeing all of this stuff that they don't like, and yet at the same time they want it and are inspired by it too.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to that comparison. I think the limitations of it, of course, is that, you know, the whites have no claim to the Orient.
That
right?
is true.
In the same, and Americans have a claim to Africa. So for them, for a lot of these artists, it's a kind of recovery work, right? If you use that term, like they're trying to recover something that was taken from them via the Middle Passage, right? Via enslavement. And so the recovery, finding inspiration, as did, you know, white artists and European artists, but in African arts, as to formulate their own kind of Black aesthetic, is very interesting, because I think they see it as borrowing, but also as recovery, right? Like there's a natural connection that they have that, for instance, Picasso doesn't, right? He doesn't have that connection, in their minds.
Are there travel narratives of the African Americans who go to Africa to describe this place for African Americans back home? And what kinds of things do they write about?
It's so funny because I'm working on this now. You know, there are individuals like the minister resident and council generals of Liberia, the U.S. So they're representing the U.S. for periods of time. They come back, they have their own writings, they describe what they see, but that's really for the government. Although a couple of them, I want to say John Smith, J. Milton Turner, a couple of others, they come back and they give speeches, right? At Black churches, at venues that are Black owned for Black audiences, and they talk about what they observed while they were in Liberia. So some of them are on the speaking circuit. Some of them also publish essays that you would find in either the AME Review or the Colored American or the African Repository, which is the ACS's, American Colonization Society's, Oregon. And they know the readership. I mean, some of it, of course, the ACS organ, you have a strong Black readership, but you also have white readership. But of course, the AME quarter review, other Black-owned newspapers, the Colored American, Black magazines, those are for Black readerships. And so a lot of times they're talking about what they see happening on the ground, particularly with Liberia. And it's a mixed bag. Sometimes there are people like, oh, this is not for us. But is very laudatory of what the African American immigrants have done. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are missionaries who go back, who go to Africa, and they send back their reports, and their mission, their reports definitely have the darkest Africa savage tropes in it, and how this work is that they're doing is really bringing light to the continent, etc. But they do, for instance, William Shepherd's reflections on his time in the Congo, I mean, a lot of it is about the people. It's a lot of thick cultural description, or we could call it ethnographic description, his meetings with various peoples. And so those are, you know, those, some of that is read by Blacks, but he's a Presbyterian, so maybe not as many. But again, a lot of it is description of culture, but also, you know, some of the same tropes that you would find in, for instance, some of the white missionary or travel narratives.
So since you bring that up, I was wondering, you know, in Stanley's writing, as you know, as well as so many other American explorers to the Arctic and other places, these expeditions are placed to express a kind of white masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
And do you find a parallel process happening with Black travelers to Africa from America?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would call it, definitely for some of the men and women, I would call it, I'll use the terms race manhood and race womanhood, you know, those ideas, which is not necessarily about going to Africa to become men, like and through some kind of strenuous activity. Think, you know, thinking about, for instance, Roosevelt's idea of the strenuous life and how you see that bleeding through a lot of American travel narratives. This is more about political, social engagement and the ways in which Black men are able to be men. And when they say that, they don't mean picking up stuff and, you know, do you get what I'm saying? Like men in a kind of social and political sense, right?
Yeah.
They are seen as men and not inferior and not subservient. And you see that also with a lot of the women who, those women that have, whose writings are still extant, who talk about their sense of accomplishment, or perhaps the better word is meaning, like finding meaning in what they're doing and how that reflects on their own sense of womanhood, right?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the kind of images of Black women back in the United States, you know, the Jezebel, the Mammy, you know, the Sapphire, those drudge, those totalizing images that restrict them. And so you see that in Shepherd's Wife's narrative, right? Thinking about what it was like for her to be in the Congo, but also the sense that she had a mission and that this work, this place allowed her to carry that out.
So I was wondering, I know that your book takes us up to 1936, but then I was struck by your introduction where you say how much as a kid you were really taken with Africa and that you had this kind of vision of it. And then years later, you traveled through West Africa as well as South Africa. Could you talk a little bit about that? I guess both the personal side and also just how the Africa in the American imagination has changed.
Yeah, I mean, as a child, I think also there were competing images. I mean, Africa was kind of a dirty word. And, you know, people would use that. When I say that, other kids would use it, like they would call people African booty scratchers and things like that. Like these kind of weird derogatory terms. But at the same time, there were people in my life who had strong connections on my father's side to Africa, meaning they had traveled there. My cousins were living there because their father was working on his PhD, that kind of stuff. My grandmother's boyfriend was African and worked at the UN. And one of my dad's cousins expatriated himself. So he left America in the 60s and lived in Africa and died there. And so it was interesting because that was a different Africa, right? So what I learned was not the stereotype, at least not coming out of my household, right?
Mm-hmm.
The cultural sites in New York, in terms of the main ones, so thinking about the museum, still had a particular view of Africa, right? That was very static. And, you know, the first time I went to Africa, I, you know, at least I got to see the dynamism, the diversity of Africa. I mean, I knew that before I went, but just to see it and to experience it, and really to see that, you know, Africans are not preoccupied with what we're doing. And, you know, I'm kind of like, oh, they must be thinking about, no, they're living their lives, right? They're doing their own thing. And I think the West has a kind of arrogance about itself that everyone's looking towards it. And that's not the case, right? I mean, they do,
right.
You know, these are decolonized places, at least, you know, so when I was there, people still had, you know, if not actual memory, but, you know, historical memories of the colonial period. But for the most part, they were caught up in their own politics, their own local and regional and national politics.
And were you working on your PhD or your book manuscript at this time, or were these travels to Africa before that?
No, the first set was while I was doing coursework, because my second field is, or my third, my minor field is pre-colonial Africa. So that's why I went to West Africa, because I wanted to go to some of the sites, the places where the, you know, medieval African kingdoms were.
Yeah.
In the West Coast. But when I was in South Africa, I was at a conference and I was also doing research for my dissertation.
So one of the things that I experience, I think it's kind of a downside of maybe studying travel or exploration, is that when you go to a new place, you're kind of both seeing the place and then you're thinking about the place as a writer thinks about it, and you're kind of examining your own experiences. I was wondering if that was going on in your head as you were traveling through Africa. Were you kind of in two places at once?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I don't know. I have to say, I feel like there were times when I was just in the moment and really wasn't thinking about it. I mean, but because one was a course, I had to constantly think about the work that I had to do for the class. And I think I was more aware of it in South Africa because I knew I was doing research there. But there were times where I just wanted to be just in the moment and not thinking about how everything would relate to how I was going to write about Africa. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what do you think? I guess you kind of gave us a preview already, but what do you think your next project's going to be?
So my current project is about the U.S. and Africa from 1847 to 1919, but I'm more interested in the foreign policy, where foreign policy meets kind of popular, not so much images, because I've done that, but popular discourses or particular discourses about the relationship between the U.S. and the rest of the world and where Africa fits into that. So a lot of it is heavily, heavily reliant on archives from, you know, the diplomatic the consular service, right? And so I am looking at American consulates in Africa, and also looking at what Europeans thought about that.
That's great.
Yeah, so it's been interesting. I'm almost finished with the research, and writing starts this semester, so I have enough to start writing, and I'm looking forward to writing this book, because I think that we really haven't looked at the consulate service, and also not just what America's relationship to Africa is, but what does that say about the U.S.'s own sense of its place in the world during that period when everyone's, you know, the so-called age of empire,
yeah.
Right? Hobbes empire. What does Africa have to do with that when we only think of African U.S. empire as being, you know, hemispheric and Pacific oriented.
Jeanette Eileen Jones, thank you for talking with me today. I really have enjoyed reading the book, and I think you do such interesting work.
Thank you, Michael.
That's our show for today. Our theme music was composed by Zabrat. If you want to listen to other episodes of Time to Eat the Dogs, subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a few moments to rate and review it. I'd like to hear what you think. If you have an idea for a guest or you just want to get in touch, email me at timetoeatthedogs, that's one word, lowercase, @gmail.com. You can also find episodes, links, blog posts, and a lot of exploration-related stuff at timetoeatthedogs.com.